from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim, in for Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, empty shelves at grocery stores are fueling anxiety about food scarcity as people shelter at home to avoid spreading or contracting novel coronavirus. Despite this rising concern, grocers and growers are telling Californians not to panic. The nation won't run out of food. But one looming question is whether there will be enough workers, from farm workers to grocery workers, to meet demand. We look at how the food supply chain is holding up next on Forum. Join us. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim, sitting in for Michael Krasny. As cases of COVID-19 began to mount in the U.S., experts urged Americans to social distance and stock up, leading to unprecedented demand on the food supply. While empty store shelves might be unsettling, growers and grocers insist food is plentiful and safe, and there's no need to buy way more at one time than you can use. The challenge, rather, is getting food to the right places with enough workers at farms, processing plants, and stores, and getting people to stop overbuying. To learn more about how the food chain is holding up so far during this pandemic, we're joined by Phil Lempert. He is editor at Supermarket Guru. Thanks for joining us, Phil Lempert.
Thank you.
Also with us is Jeffrey Mohan. He's a reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Thanks for joining us, Jeffrey Mohan.
Thank you.
And Phil, I'd like to start with you. Can you just remind us of all the components along the food supply chain, this big, complex, and interconnected system that we don't often think about when we're buying food?
Well, we don't. And let's remember that most food actually starts from the ground. So we've got to rely on our farmers. We've got to rely on their farm labor out there to grow the stuff that then turns into whether it's a frozen dinner or a can of food or, you know, a loaf of bread. So it starts there. And then from there, it then goes to a processing facility where it is cleaned, where it's washed, where it's processed, then has to go to a warehouse, then from the warehouse, then gets delivered to a supermarket, for example, or for a restaurant. So there's probably about 20, 25 touch points along the way from the time that an ingredient comes out of the ground to the time it winds up on our dining room table.
And Jeffrey Mohan, I mean, can you talk about the unprecedented nature of the demand that people all along the supply chain are seeing right now?
Yeah, what's happened basically is people have defied a model that's been going on for quite a number of years of just-in-time supply. So they're rushing out and kind of breaking the rules on how they buy and when they buy, pushing up demand in a kind of short cycle manner. So groceries that had long created their business model on just-in-time delivery can't handle that type of demand.
And we do have Ronald Fong on the line. He's actually president and CEO of the California Grocers Association. Ronald Fong, thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
So if we're hearing from grocers that we're not going to run out of food, the reason that we're seeing empty shelves is purely a function of overbuying at this point?
There is a nuance to be described here. The supply chain is intact. It's plentiful. It's safe. That's the amount of product, whether it's general merchandise, paper products, to the food supply that the others have talked about. That is intact. What we're having compromised right now is the distribution channels. Those are being compromised, and there is a difference between the two. We can't get the products to our grocery stores fast enough because of this new shopping patterns that our customers have displayed over the past few weeks.
So what amount of food should people buy for, like just for a week or two?
Yeah, we're recommending that our customers are educated to know that the supply chain is intact, that we do need some time to get things back to normal. If your normal shopping pattern is to buy for a week or a little over a week for your family, that's what grocery retail is used to. We're able to react to that type of pattern. But we're seeing customers, some customers, that are literally buying for 3 months or 6 months. And if we continue this type of shopping pattern, there's no way our distribution channels can catch up with that kind of volume. If we return to our normal shopping patterns, and for those people that have shopped ahead, we ask you just not to do it anymore. In a few weeks, our distribution channels will be able to catch up.
One of the big problems that we're hearing grocers say is that they're concerned about having enough employees in the stores. How is that going? What are you hearing from members of your group?
I'm glad that you brought that up. Our employees are our unsung heroes. They really have been working double shifts, extra hours to react to this volume of customers that we have. So they are spending time stocking. We're closing the stores a little early to deal with the sanitation and the cleanliness of our markets. We want to prep our stores for the next day. We want to give our employees time to restock the stores without customers watching over them so that they can get it ready for the next morning.
We've been hearing that there have been concerns about safety and about, you know, potentially catching the illness if you're a store worker. I mean, it's hard to do social distancing as a checkout clerk, and we know that there's a shortage of personal protective equipment and things like hand sanitizers. So are workers getting this kind of these kinds of safety, you know, materials and medical supplies if they request them at these grocery stores?
It is difficult. You know, our industry is suffering the same challenges as healthcare and everybody else trying to get PPEs into our store. What I will tell you is that we are doing the best that we can to adhere to the social distancing policies, and every store has sort of their own procedures and their own programs. For instance, in our check stands, many stores have gone to measuring out six-foot distances with simple painter's tape that they tape on the floor, and that gives our customers an idea of where to stand so that we're not on top of each other in the check stands. We're also hiring extra security in case there are lines outside our door to distance the people that are standing in line to get into our stores first thing in the morning. So we're taking measures like that to the best of our ability to practice social distancing in our grocery stores.
Ronald Fong, he's president and CEO of California Grocers Association, a nonprofit trade group that represents over 300 retail members in California and Nevada. Thanks so much for joining us, Ronald Fong.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
And we also have on the line with us Armando Alinas. He's secretary treasurer of the United Farm Workers. Hi, Armando.
Yeah, hi. Good morning.
Thanks so much for joining us. You know, one of the things that we were just talking about was how this food supply chain, of course, begins with farm workers. And I'm wondering what you are hearing from people in the fields, whether or not they are feeling pressure to work when they're sick, given the increased demand, what kinds of policies have been put in place to ensure their safety, if they feel like they're getting the information they need.
Well, you just opened up a huge can of stuff. You know, unfortunately, not much is changing for a lot of farm workers in terms of most growers are still operating as usual. And so now we understand that there's some difficulty for some that have, for example, to practice working with social distancing, especially if you're on a machine that requires you to be, you know, side by side somebody. But some places it's easier. But most farm workers, unfortunately, are one, being instructed to go to work. They're not being provided enough information of how to implement best practices at home or at the job site. And some are, you know, being advised that if they are sick, they will stop the entire crew. So when you don't have sick hours, when you don't have that available, unfortunately, that sends a message to the workers, you know, that that if you call in sick or if you say you're sick, you're going to be responsible for stopping the entire crew. So that puts a lot of pressure on somebody not to say something. And so, you know, that's really scary. And lastly, you know, workers are really petrified of on both sides. One, of losing work because they don't have a safety net. You know, if they're not working, they're not going to get unemployment insurance just because most of them are undocumented. And petrified of going to work and then being exposed to a virus, but not being able to deal with it because they have no health care. So they're really scared. They are going to work because they feel they have no choice. They feel obligated because of the fact that they have to pay the bills. And but on the same side, there are also some that, you know, that recognize, and some are incredulous, actually, now that growers are labeling them essential workers. And some growers, even though it's not required by the law, some growers or by the governor's orders, growers are given letters to the workers saying, you're an essential worker, you know, use this to report to work. And so the workers are responding by, okay, now we're essential. We're getting paid minimum wage. We're not getting benefits, but now we're essential. But we're not essential enough because it doesn't show up on our paycheck. We're not essential enough because we're not getting the protections. So, you know, so they appreciate, you know, in one way, they appreciate being labeled and recognized because they've always been essential. You know, when we're talking about healthcare workers who are out in the front lines dealing with all these people that are going to the hospitals, we talk about grocery workers that are, you know, coming in daily contact with so many folks as they're trying to process and trying to pay for the food they're buying. You know, they've always been essential, but the workers are, you know, saying, you know what? Yes, we recognize we're essential, but we want essential benefits. We want essential rights that we need as workers so that we can protect our families as well. And we would hope that. Go ahead.
Armando, do you feel like the UFW is in a better position to advocate for better wages and working conditions as a result of the demand now in particular?
You know, I'm not sure. I would hope we're trying to do our part. We're trying to do our part on behalf of all workers, not just our members, on behalf of all workers, because we feel we have an obligation to raise the voice of the farm workers, to, you know, bring attention to this issue, because there's hundreds of thousands of farm workers across the country that are harvesting our fruits and vegetables that they have been labeled essential, but they're not being provided the essential benefits and the essential rights they deserve. And so, you know, we're trying to do our part. We're trying to figure out how they're going to be provided the assistance. And these are the most vulnerable workers. This is the backbone of the food supply chain. And they're being excluded because the majority are undocumented. So they're not going to get access to all that benefit package that the Congress is considering. They're not going to get access. And on the other side of the stick, they're having to go to work, as we all seen. You know, in the morning, people are lined up to go into the supermarket store to buy those essential products that they need, which farm workers are harvesting. But the workers themselves are at work, so they can't really go shopping. And by the time they get off of work, you know, the shelves are even more bare because they don't have that luxury of going early in the morning when everybody else is at home. So I think, you know, we need to take into consideration, and we would hope just as quickly as the growers started printing up letters so that workers can go to work, we would like for them to just as quickly give them the protections and benefits they deserve so that the workers can feel safe, they can feel – or safer, so they can feel – comfortable trying to feed America, because I don't think most people realize that, for example, that strawberry, you know, that somebody's eating, that strawberry was the last hand that touched that strawberry was a farm worker's hands.
Well, Jeffrey Mohan, one of the things, even with the hundreds of thousands of workers that Armando is talking about, that there is concern that there will be a labor shortfall. Can you talk about what's driving that?
Yeah, the agriculture industry in California has increasingly been resorting to use of agricultural guest workers from Mexico, predominantly from Mexico, in what's known as the H-2A visa program. We have ratcheted that up in California to the point where we're now recruiting somewhere on the order of 20,000 to 25,000 workers per year. And while that's only a fraction of the estimated maybe 450,000 agricultural workers employed at any one time employed in California, that kind of masks a very, very deep dependency in certain crops in certain regions. Armando mentioned strawberries. That's one of the big ones in the Central Coast and in Monterey, where the strawberry season is getting underway. They depend very heavily on these foreign guest workers. And the consulates are closed. They are still processing these visas, but they're processing them with a priority on the returning workers who have had a visa within the past 12 months. Nobody knows what percentage of the workforce that would be, but if you are a new H-2A recruit or one who hasn't worked in the past 12 months in California, you still have to go through a number of hoops that require in-person interviews and things of that sort that are strictly forbidden at this point at the consulates. And they don't appear to be resorting to any other technological means to do this. They're not adopting any video conferencing or any of those measures yet. So that's going to slow the flow. And just like the rest of the supply chain, the labor supply chain is also just as needed. So workers get these visas, they cross the border, they're on a bus, and they're at work within the week. So any slowdown really is going to affect perishable crops like strawberries that need someone to pick them immediately and could potentially spoil within a day or two.
And in addition, if a worker was to get sick, I mean, how much would that wipe out a labor force that's working in a particular field or even in a processing plant down the food supply chain, Jeffrey Mohan?
Yeah, Armando hit the nail on the head. You know, there's the practices on paper and the practices in the field. And workers work by crew. They're very, very cohesive. They're very dependent upon each other. It's a ballet. If you ever watch them do it, it's a tremendous orchestration of movements and of machinery.
Yes, so I have actually in the vineyards here in the wine country. It is. It's pretty amazing.
Right, and we've switched to field packing in many of our crops. So there's a sense that you're going to let the crew down if you're not going to show up or if you report sick. The other thing I would add, though, to counter that is that you have to remember that in the agricultural industry, there are very tight regulations on food safety. So you'll often see crews out there. They have masks on. They have gloves on. Some of them have chaps. They have aprons. They have all kinds of protective equipment that they've already been using, and they have been drilled endlessly in washing their hands and those kinds of hygiene practices. So more than a lot of other people in the workforce, I think farm workers have at least at some point been told about hygienic practices. Now, again, when you get to the field, the way that these things are enforced or may vary from field to field, I would imagine now people are getting really serious about enforcing these. But there's what's done on paper and there's what's done on the field level.
So far, Jeffrey Mohan, are you hearing whether or not the virus has reached farm workers?
I spoke with a health network that serves the Santa Maria area, which is in northern Santa Barbara and southern San Luis Obispo County, and they so far had said that they had no evidence it had reached that community, but they are having quite a difficult time getting out to speak with these workers, getting them to come into clinics. They were building last week. We're still building heated tents at some of their clinics for drive-through visits where they were also distributing food. The most telling thing that I heard from one of the health coordinators there was that the default practice for a lot of these farm workers when they're sick with flu-like symptoms or cold symptoms is actually to do nothing, to go to work. So many of them had no idea what they ought to do now when those symptoms are being taken so seriously. And that really gets to that central irony of farm workers are now considered essential, though much of the year they're completely ignored and invisible to most people. I mean, they don't even work the same hours. They're out at 5 a.m. and back at 3 or 4 p.m., and nobody ever notices. So
we're talking. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so they never had good access to health care in the first place. And they always had incredible pressure to show up to work because it's the only thing they really have.
We're talking with Jeff Mohan. He's a reporter for the Los Angeles Times, Armando Elena, Secretary-Treasurer of the United Farm Workers, and Phil Lempert, editor at Supermarket Guru. And we're talking with you, our listeners. What are your questions about our food supply, about our farm workers and labor shortage concerns? What have you been doing or noticing when you go shopping? Give us a call, 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. Post your questions or comments on Facebook, tweet us at KQED Forum, or email us at forum@kqed.org. And I should note, we also invited the Farm Bureau Federation and Western Growers Association to participate in today's show, but they did not respond. Though, Phil Lempert, in addition to farmers facing challenges in terms of labor shortages and keeping farm workers safe and healthy, the other thing that it seems like they're facing is this need to try to redirect food, especially if it was meant for restaurants or major corporations and those entities, and try to redirect them to more retail. What are you hearing along those lines?
Well, what we're actually seeing, especially here in California, with the closure of restaurants, is we're seeing a lot of food service distributors now opening up to consumers so that, you know, you could go and buy a number 10 tin, if you would. Number 10 is one of those big cans, if you would, of corn or green beans or anything that a restaurant would buy. So the restaurants have to reinvent themselves. And one of the problems, not only on the farm, but through the entire supply chain, is this labor factor. Now, keep in mind, we gear up when it comes to Thanksgiving. We gear up when it comes to Christmas because we know that people are going to go out there and they're going to buy a lot of food. The other problem that we've got, and for those people who've been ordering, you know, delivery services, whether it be food service or Instacart or Shipt and so on, is you used to be able to get deliveries within an hour or 2 hours. Now it could take you 3 or 4 days until you get a delivery. In fact, Instacart just announced yesterday that they're looking for another 300,000 workers. We also have a big problem when it comes to truck drivers, because truck drivers have been retiring. We've had a shortage of truck drivers over the past 2 years, and frankly, nobody wakes up in the morning saying, hey, I want to be a truck driver.
Well, we'll talk more about those issues in the food supply chain after the break. Stay with us. I'm Mina Kim. This is Forum. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Empty shelves at grocery stores are fueling anxiety about food scarcity as people shelter at home to avoid spreading or contracting COVID-19. But growers and grocers are assuring citizens not to panic. America won't run out of food. But there are some concerns about this food supply chain holding up. And we're talking with Jeff Mohan of the Los Angeles Times, Phil Lempert of Supermarket Guru, and Armando Elena, Secretary-Treasurer of the United Farm Workers, about how things are going and what are some of the concerns that they have down the line as this pandemic continues. And we're talking with you, our listeners. What are your questions about the food supply for our guests? How are you managing your food supply during this crisis? And how are you helping others? Give us a call at 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You can post your comments on Facebook, Twitter, or email us at forum@kqed.org. And Jeffrey Mohan, you know, as we were going to the break, Phil Lempert was just talking about all the different ways that the supply chain has had to adjust. And, you know, I noted as restaurants have decreased orders, grocery stores are increasing orders. How easy is it for a farm to adjust its operations to adapt to that?
I don't know necessarily that the farms are needing to do much adjustment. One of the other commenters mentioned earlier, the supply is there. It's a matter of getting the supply across the gap between the farm and the grocery aisles. The biggest problem agriculture tends to have is labor and weather, and those are two things that are greatly affecting things at the moment. Prior to coronavirus, one of the problems that was starting to show up was simply weather-related shortages. There was too much rain in the desert region where the bulk of anything green and any produce is grown during the winter. So it's not so much a question of ramping up as it is a question of keeping the production level at the levels it used to be.
Well, let me go to caller Antonio in Piedmont. Hi, Antonio.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Well, I grew up in a family where we were farm workers, including the strawberries and apples and raspberries and all sorts of things, tomatoes and chilies. And I'm just wondering what is going to be done to advocate and to bring up the level of humanity for what the workers deserve out there working in the fields with all the pesticides. I marched with Cesar Chavez in the past when he was around doing his advocacy for workers, and not much has changed. I mean, the pesticides out there are poisoning people, and now we have all this pressure on them to keep working because they're essential. But what is actually going to be done to help their essential work be safer and cohesive in this time of crisis?
Antonio, thanks. Armando Alenis, we touched on this a little bit, but do you have some more thoughts for Antonio?
Yeah, no, thank you, Antonio. And I agree. I mean, there's been a lot of done in terms of, and Jeffrey mentioned it, in terms of, you know, we have a saying called the laws in the books are not the laws in the fields. And so much has been done in terms of the laws, you know, such as paid sick days. They're supposed to have paid access to paid sick days. They're supposed to have protective equipment. But unfortunately, it's the implementation of those laws and the lack of representation of farm workers in the farms that allow for these practices. So and that's what we're calling attention to, because right now, you know, growers are basically continuing business as usual for a lot of them. Not all of them. Some of them are stepping up. I want to be clear, but they are right now, you know, labeling the workers essential. They were quick to print up letters so that the workers can show them to any police officer, even though they're not required. But they're not being quick to actually train them on the best practices. They're not being quick to actually provide assurances that, hey, if you get sick, it's okay. Go ahead and report it. We'll provide you sick pay. On the contrary, you know, they're being told, okay, you're sick. Where's your doctor's note? I don't have health care. Well, you know, then you don't get sick pay. So that tells the workers as well, might as well not even try. That's the message that they're getting. And when we're asking the growers nationwide to treat these workers as essential, and the growers are actually using those arguments right now towards essential workers are saying, well, we need H-2A workers because they're essential, because they're experienced. But that's only 10% of the workforce. Think about that. 10% of the workforce, 90% are the ones that are currently working. And there's a flood happening where workers are moving into the fields right now where they're desperately looking for work. But what are we doing for both sides? How do we protect the workers that are currently here? How do we ensure, if there is going to be H-2A workers coming in, that they have the protections that they need? Because right now they're being housed in labor camps, type of situations where they're 4, 6, 8, 10 to a room. So how do we ensure that there's practices in place? How do we ensure that they have health care? Most of our union growers have health care, you know, and we're very proud of them because they are being proactive. I mean, I can point to Swanton Berry in Santa Cruz. They right away told the workers, hey, don't worry. If you get sick, we'll take care of you. You have health care, and, you know, you're not going to lose pay. Mondavi up in Napa, They had two workers that they were having to lay off. The company themselves called and said, hey, how do we make sure that these workers don't lose their health coverage? The company provides health coverage for the entire family, 100% paid for by the company, for family, medical, dental, and vision. The employee pays nothing. And we have other companies that are stepped up, like the Arrigo brothers in the Salinas Valley, where they provide 100% coverage for healthcare, medical, dental, and vision, 100% paid for by the company, and they're training their workers. They're giving them those tools, and the workers have the voice, the representation, and therefore the confidence to speak up and say, we need to fix this. You know, but non-union workers are being basically told, just report to work. So we need to figure out how do we step up and recognize that these essential farm workers need essential benefits and rights.
Antonio, thanks for the question. Mike writes, do any of your guests see any changes in your industry after this public epidemic is over? I mean, Phil Lempert, I'm assuming that Mike is asking all along the food supply chain, because there is so much happening that is, you know, bringing new insights into how our food supply system operates. Do you see the industry making any significant changes?
Absolutely. And just to build on one thing that Antonio had brought up, we are spoiled here in the U.S. We've got the cheapest food supply ever. A fair dollar is not going to the farmer. And when we look at supermarkets, they're working on 1.5% margin. The problem is that our food supply is too cheap. So whether it's health care, whether it's benefits, I don't know where all this money is coming from, that now all of a sudden all the supermarkets are hiring all these extra people. They're giving them bonuses if they work. We as consumers are going to have to pay for that, and we can't forget that. As far as the changes go, I see this as really a bell curve. We're you know, not at the top yet. It is going to slow down in another 2 or 3 weeks. We will see, you know, fully stocked supermarkets. But there's two other things that are happening that nobody's talking about. Number one is we get a lot of food from China. We get a lot of poultry from there. We get about 25% of our processed mushrooms from there. We get about 25% of our garlic from there. We get a lot of food service produce from there. And then also what's going on over in the EU. So all these factories are closed right now. So as much of a supply chain problem that we have now, it's going to take them weeks to get their factories back up and to be able to fulfill those supply chains. And we have this fight going on between Boeing and Airbus, and the government has now put, you know, 20 to 100% tariffs on imported foods from, even though it has nothing to do with planes, from Italy and from France. And so our cheeses, our wines that we love, not only are they going to be more expensive, but again, those factories are shut. So, you know, again, we're at one part right now. It's going to get resupplied, and then we're going to have another shortage of some other products having nothing to do with coronavirus.
So people should realize that there will be items that will become more scarce, even if we don't feel it right now.
Absolutely. And when we look at the amount of food that we import from China, it is substantial. And I'm not, you know, everybody's made headlines about soybeans, but we look at poultry, we look at seafood that's coming from there. We will see shortages and we will see higher prices.
You mean headlines about soybeans because there have been excesses of those in the U.S. as a result of slowdown of exports to China?
Correct. That's been the problem.
So people have this false sense of what we have an oversupply of and are not realizing what we may potentially have an undersupply of. Is that what you're saying, Phil Lempert?
Yes. And also keep in mind that a lot of the soybeans that the farmers have kept in storage for 2 or 3 years are now almost to the expiration date. So what we're going to see is we're going to see farmers who are going to have to dump a lot of soybeans and, frankly, lose a lot of money. And it's all about money, and it's great headlines when we see, you know, these supermarkets going out there offering bonuses to people and so on. But you and I, as consumers, are going to be paying for it. Let's not forget that.
Well, this listener tweets, Berkeley Bowl workers have won a $2 an hour raise for hazard pay during the COVID-19 crisis. Management has agreed to make it through at least April 18th. Over 1,000 people signed a petition to support the workers. And so, Mike, another listener writes, do any of your guests see, oh, no, sorry, Margaret writes, are grocery stores and healthcare workers getting some kind of hazard pay? So we're hearing that at Berkeley Bowl, but are we seeing this on a broader scale?
Yes.
Yeah, we Target, Safeway.
Jeff Mohan, is that you?
No, that's Armando.
Oh, Armando, I see. At Target and Safeway, we're seeing some hazard pay coming in.
Yeah, Target and Safeway,
globally,
well, corporate.
You know, and you know, folks like Walmart, just about every supermarket, Whole Foods, they are giving quote unquote hazard pay or bonuses to their employees. Yes.
Well, here's Mike, who agrees with you, Phil, on the food is too cheap part of this. Mike writes, I operate a 20-acre fruit and vegetable farm in Solano County. I have no workers. I can't afford them. Through a labor contractor, a worker costs me about $23 an hour, and it doesn't pencil out. So a lot of produce is unharvested. The underlying problem is that food in our country is badly underpriced. Jeff Mohan, do you have a sense of how small farmers are doing, the folks, for example, who sell direct to consumers or to restaurants at farmers markets and things like that?
There's no data available. Unfortunately, yet these things tend to operate pretty slowly in terms of getting raw data. But what I am hearing anecdotally is that it's much more difficult for the small farmer and much more difficult for somebody who might be hitched very closely to, for instance, food service. It's really difficult to pivot from a virtual stop in the food service side in some areas to suddenly going direct to consumers or into retail. So, yes, it's extremely difficult for them.
Well, Phil Lempert, I know you need to leave us, so I just wanted to give you a chance. If there are any final thoughts you think that people should keep in mind as they are out there purchasing food, stocking up, and trying to figure out how best to support people through this pandemic who work in our food chain system.
Don't stock up. You know, just buy what you need. And I visited this past weekend probably about 15 stores, and I would say maybe 30% of the shelves are stocked. You know, we don't have to go buy 100 rolls of toilet paper. We're fine. There's enough toilet paper that's being produced by those companies, and we just need to be a little patient. Don't stock up. Don't panic. And also, let's not forget probably the most important thing in fighting coronavirus is having a strong immunity system. So what you really want to do is you want to eat a lot of citrus. You want to have a lot of leafy greens. You want to eat healthy in order to keep your system strong so that you don't contract the virus.
Phil Lempert, editor at Supermarket Guru, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And let me go to our callers, Iris in Oakland. Hi, Iris, join us.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question. I grew up as a farm worker, and my father was through the Bracero program. And we had the ability to, we were sponsored and then became permanent residents here in the United States. I'm wondering, is that since we are considered essential workers, I mean, I'm not a farm worker anymore, as essential workers, an essential part of the economy, when will politicians recognize that we need to bring them in not just as temporary workers, but to have a pathway for citizenship? Any comments on politicians and what they may be doing to that? Because I think that they are incredibly important, and none of my kids want to be farm workers. So where are we going to be replacing that workforce?
Iris, thanks. Jeff Mohan?
We are going through what may go down as one of the toughest anti-immigrant environments in modern political history right now. So the chances of immigration reform that would include a path to citizenship for farm workers are nil, as far as I can see. These kind of proposals are made frequently. There are a great many politicians who know exactly what ought to be done and what needs to be done, but they seldom make it out of committee. If they make it out of committee, they seldom make it through the floor, and then they die in the Senate. So unfortunately, I don't think we're going to get that kind of reform anytime soon.
Well, Iris, thanks for that question. You know, one of the things, Jeff Mohan, that has come up, of course, is that the Trump administration has talked about stopping the processing of visas for U.S. entry at the border, though they're saying that they'll make exceptions for commercial transit. But do you see slowdowns on the commercial side of things just because of the clampdown at the border generally?
That's really hard to predict. I assume you're talking about truck traffic going back and forth.
Yeah.
It seems like they're going to leave that alone, and it seems like if they're limiting the amount of traffic that's non-commercial, it may be, in fact, a little bit easier to cross the border. But again, you know, all of these things balance precariously on the back of labor. If you don't have the drivers, then you don't have the trucks. If you don't have the people picking and packing, then you don't have any contents for the trucks.
Right. Well, Chris writes, I work in the food security sector and am grateful to be employed despite the hazardous conditions. We know that anyone can be an asymptomatic carrier, and we know that paper masks do not protect you from getting the virus, but they do help prevent the spread of the virus. We need mandatory masks for everyone for all retail spaces. This seems to me to be the most obvious and effective way to flatten the curve. Armando Alenas, what has the federal government said or public health workers about, you know, whether food or food packaging transmits the coronavirus?
I think it's still they're talking about how it lives longer on certain surfaces. But I don't think they've gone as far as saying that it lives on fruit or vegetables for that much of extended period of time. And so I think it's still to be seen, but that's why we're really stressing, and why we stress when we sent the letter to the ag industry, the best practices, we thought that would be the minimum they could do, in terms of the best practices of washing their hands. I was talking to workers yesterday, and picking mandarin who don't even have water, who have not been trained yet. And these are not the small operators. These are the big companies. And so that's really disheartening, because we think we all have a role to play. And so we think those best practices, the simple best practices, yes, they require time, but that's pretty much it. And yes, it might slow down the efficiency, but it is for the greater good. And so we've been asking that the grower community step up and give these workers the training that they need, give these workers the assurances they need, so that they can be safer when they're out there working. And lastly, we want to make sure that it is a race to the top, not a race to the bottom, as it currently stands right now. It's very, very difficult, and I also, you know, recognize that some growers are facing a tremendous amount of pressure from the retail industry, where they're pushing prices down, and so therefore it makes it very difficult for a grower that wants to do the right thing to do so. But there are some.
Yes, it's so interesting. You know, there are already issues in the food supply chain, but this pandemic has just exacerbated those issues so dramatically. Let me go to caller Mishwa in San Francisco. And again, that number 866-733-6786 if you want to join the conversation. Mishwa in San Francisco. Hello.
So essential, and this is the first program that I've heard in during this epidemic, this pandemic, to deal with our food issues and our agriculture system. Armando, I want to thank you for your knowledge and all the work that you do to represent farm workers. I am a retired school teacher, but also a community gardener for the last 10 years. here in Baby Hunter's Point of San Francisco. And the challenges of growing food that's free from insect damage and with the climate chaos going on and unpredictability, there are so many challenges. And the work is so hard, just physically hard. And we need to honor farm workers and small farmers with full rights. And it's just unconscionable how we've treated our farm workers and how we take advantage of them, and they don't have the protections they need. So I'd like to hear more from Armando about what just ordinary citizens can do. And I also want to mention the Green New Deal. I'm being a high school teacher in the past, I see so many young people needing work, being interested in working outdoors, in nurseries, in landscaping, in sustainable agriculture. And yet there's you know, the pay is terrible. There's no pathway. And one thing that the Green New Deal would include is a real strong focus on sustainable agriculture and a pathway to citizenship.
Well, Mishwa, thanks. Armando, things that ordinary citizens can do.
I mean, I think there's a lot we can do. We can definitely uplift the stories of what's happening. We've been trying to do that through our Facebook, through the UFW Facebook, through calling out our different Congress members to step up and ensure that the farm workers have the protections that they need and the benefits that they need. For example, as Jeffrey mentioned before, we have a large percentage of the farm worker population, and our understanding is that more than 60% of the farm worker population is undocumented. So the assistance that the Congress is currently negotiating, unfortunately, is probably going to exclude most of them because they're undocumented. So so I think visiting our UFW website, our page, we're trying to figure out how to get the stories out there that these workers are working out there right now while we're at home, while we're supposed to be at home. Their workers are harvesting our food. They're trying to provide something for us as consumers. And we have to understand how important, because most of us don't understand. We go to the supermarket, we buy the strawberry, we take it out of the clamshell, we put it in our mouth. The last hand that touched that strawberry was a farm worker. It wasn't a machine. It wasn't washed. It was a farm worker that picked, arranged it so it's nice and pretty for the consumer, so it's facing up, so all the blemishes are gone, and then they put it in the clamshell, and then it goes to the supermarket. The consumer takes it out of the clamshell, puts it in their mouth, and so the last hand that touched that food was a farm worker's hands. And we're trying to uplift those stories and share to the Congress that farm workers need to be taken into consideration, that they are essential and need the protections, need the benefits, because you know what? It is hard work. It is. Mm-hmm. But it's honorable work. It is respectable work. It takes skill. It takes ability. So if you've ever been out there, you will recognize right away that it does take skill. Now, do we need to improve the pay? We need to improve the benefits? Yes.
Yes. And let me try to bring in a couple more callers just before we run out of time. Bill in Auburn wants to join us. Hi, Bill.
Hi. Thanks so much for the conversation. Yeah, it seems to me, if we had some situation where we had workers that had their own say, if they had the political, capacity, say in a worker-owned, worker-run co-op, they would be making the decisions about what to produce, where to produce it, how to produce it, and what to do with the profits. You know, the decision-making tree would be very, very different for their welfare. So politicians can come into the fold by supporting that and helping grow out a viable sector of worker-owned, worker-run co-ops. That would actually be a true democracy in the workplace. You know, currently what we have is it's an autocracy. We have a very small number of people, very small, making all the shots and then, basically keeping most of the profits. So with a true democracy at the workplace level, you turn the whole scenario up on its head. You have the base, the workers themselves, they have real power then. And so that's going to change everything across the board, from the impacts on the environment, the impacts on their health. And so politicians can support growing that viable sector of our economy out. And then in the meantime, that's going to take a while. You know, basically what they can do is create more transparency. Which farms, I'd love to know which farms actually treat their workers in a humane way. And so if we knew that as consumers, we could make choices right with our dollar. And that would then shift the current system quickly while we move to an actually more functional and a true democratic system.
Bill, thanks. And on the retail side, we have a couple of comments. Martin writes, supermarkets do not operate on a 1% margin. They charge whatever they can get away with at all times. They can pay their CEO multi-million dollar salaries and perks, not to mention Walmart, the biggest of all and owned by the richest family in America. I wonder how they got rich. We need price controls. And Rachel writes, when you see empty store shelves, people want to buy even more. All of this is compounded by the fact that now people are needing to stock food for the entire family for three meals per day. Previously, my husband got free lunch at work and my daughter ate at school every day. Now they're eating all their meals at home. Well, I want to thank our listeners for drawing attention to what they're experiencing and also their thoughts and questions for our guests. Jeffrey Mohan, reporter with the Los Angeles Times, Armando Elena, Secretary Treasurer of the United Farm Workers. And earlier we were joined by Phil Lempert of Supermarket Guru and Ronald Fong of the California Grocers Association. This is Forum. I'm Mina Kim. Thanks so much for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.